how do people follow this one? Maybe they want to support him or learn more about it. Or
freedonziger.com, D-O-N-Z-I-G-E-R, freedonziger.com. And there's a story about the sickening lack of media coverage or misinformation from New York Times and others at gregpalast.com.
Great. That's great. Thank you, Greg Palast, gregpalast.com. As always, we appreciate the good work. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Wraps it up for you. Flashpoint.
Are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Welcome to Between the Covers, conversations about books and the people who write them, here at KBOO Portland 97 FM. I'm your host this week, Avi Marr. Our guest today is poet Julia Levine. We're here to talk about her new poetry collection from LSU Press, Ordinary Psalms. Julia Levine is the author of four previous poetry collections: Ditch Tender, Ask, winner of the Tampa Review Prize for Poetry, Practicing for Heaven, winner of the Anhinga Prize for Poetry, and Small Disasters Seen in Sunlight, winner of the Northern California Book Award for Poetry. She is the recipient of the Discovery, the Nation Award, and the Pablo Neruda Prize for Poetry from Nimrod. Her work has been widely published in journals such as Plowshares, Prairie Schooner, and the Southern Review. Most recently, she was selected as Poet Laureate of Davis, California. Poet Jane Mead says of Julia Levine's Small Disasters Seen in Sunlight, "In Confessions, St. Augustine wrote that the soul is a house too small for God to enter, though it can be enlarged, remade. The subjects in these poems, children given the most brutal of beginnings, conjoined twins separated at the cost of one life, the last blue whale, the child whose completeness is not yet torn by time, the rape victim struggling to heal, reverberate with large questions. Can two bodies share one soul? Can one soul share two bodies? Does the soul fight death? What if there is no death, only moments looking elsewhere? Finely honed and meticulously observed, these grounded poems circle around the biggest mystery and struggle, that it can enlarge the soul." and Dorianne Lux says of ordinary psalms, it's like being underwater or driving fast beside a forest of tessellating trees, a confusion of green and trunks clacking by like railroad tracks. Read on and be both lifted and saddened. Read on and be dazzled. Julia Levine joins us from her home in Davis, California. Welcome, Julia.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Avi.
I'm hoping we can start by having you read in the October ER.
Of course, I'd be happy to. In the October ER. The argument the body goes on having repeats itself in the nurses busy with needles and electrodes, Mary tied once more into a gown. Just before she phoned, I was cleaning the pantry, dumping infested flour, rice bubbling with grain moths, black widows scuttling through the shelled and crumbling dark. Now only a thin curtain separates us from the public suffering, a man vomiting, a baby screaming between coughs. I wish I could believe in God's plan instead of science, she says. Later I will bring her warm toast, hold her skeletal frame against mine, dreaming our compost fluttering up as wing spore, a feral cloud, then wait with her for whatever comes next, blood work, CT scan, EKG, both of us watching an elephant herd cross a river on the room's TV, the youngest nearly carried away, except first one, then another giant animal hurries to stand deep in the swift running until the calf floats inside the levee of their assembled weight. Now or later, hers or mine, either way, everyone knows how the body ends, how the soul scents the current and wades in, singing to the heart as it drowns.
The themes of the natural world, the image of animals working together as saviors in this poem, seems to be a good place to start for the main threads that you follow throughout your new book. Moral courage, the interconnectedness of the physical body and the earth, the gritty fight for survival. Can you tell us what was preoccupying you during your writing for this collection?
Absolutely. I was trying to answer a question my daughter had asked me 30 plus years earlier, which is, do you believe in God, Mom? And at the time I told her, I don't know, she was only 7. And she said, well, you better hurry up and figure it out. And I didn't feel a great urgency to answer the question until I had several very upsetting things happen. One was that one of my friends, my best friend actually, had been in a terrible skydiving accident and was in terrible pain and couldn't live with it and ultimately committed suicide. And that was just devastating. And then a few years later, my friend Mary was diagnosed with a terminal illness and very recently passed away. And finally, I've had a degenerative eye condition my whole life, but during this same period of time, I suddenly lost a lot of vision, almost all of it in one eye, and it was very damaged in the other. So I had to really contend with a whole new reality where I couldn't really see very well. So it felt actually quite important to start thinking about this question of God. And so I decided to read a whole lot of religious texts, and I went through a bunch of different texts. And one of the things that really struck me was the Book of Psalms, because it's not just about praise and reverence, which I'm very suspicious of. I'm still not sure that that's really how I would speak to God. And it feels like you're sort of forced to praise and revere, and that just didn't fit my personality very well. But in the Book of Psalms, there's so much doubt and agonizing and torment and rage and anger, and I could relate to that. That's what I felt. And I felt like, ha, I better really read and study this book. This has a lot of answers in it. And so that's how the whole project was sort of conceived for me.
Your title, Ordinary Psalms, also the title of several poems in your collection, alludes to your inquiry in the meeting of the mundane with the sacred, religiously or spiritually? How are you exploring the meeting of the psalm, which is more of a formal address to a theistic God, with the ordinary?
Well, it's a really good observation on your part, Avi. It is true. It is a bit of a conceit, you know, when you find something that really works, to use it again and again. And, you know, anaphora, the device of repeating refrains or repeating lines or structuring a poem through repetition, is a really powerful, both a poetic device, but it's a really powerful religious device. You know, there's a lot of anaphora in prayer. And so I like the idea of repeating things in the book, but I wanted it to be ordinary in the sense that I don't know what I think, or at least I didn't when I began this project. I didn't know what I thought about sacred apart from the extraordinary ordinariness of the world. So there's that amazing thing about, like, for example, the little bit in the poem where the animals are working together to keep the baby from drowning. It's just remarkable to see. And it was so striking to think about that little snippet in relationship to how we all, in very heroic ways, want to be there for our friends as they're dying, even as it is just tearing us apart. I mean, it's one of the hardest things to go through, is the helplessness and the sadness of seeing someone you love in pain and you can't fix it and you know they're leaving. There is something so extraordinary about both those things to me. And I felt like, why would I need a concept of divinity beyond that? Do I need a concept of divinity beyond that? And I have to say, I ended up this project with a much better sense of God, but it does not feel to me like it's apart from the natural world or the ordinary life of a human being.
It reminds me of sort of the way sometimes we talk about crisis opening a door to spirituality, that it's the deepening of your humanity, that it's a walk down the stairs into the sacred, not some kind of sterile ascension. And it sounds like that's what you're kind of grappling with in these poems, in these very grounded ways with the human body and the earth and the animal world, quite specifically. And I think that's part of why the images are so striking.
Well, that is really lovely the way you said that, Avi. And I love that, that the crisis opens the door and you walk down into it, because there is a lot of down and darkness in there, or as, you know, Vivi Francis would say, the descendant gesture versus the ascendant gesture. But it makes me think of something I heard Bonnie Raitt say at a concert in Portland, of all places, when she was on stage. I'm a real Bonnie Raitt groupie. And she was on stage and she said, you know, religion is for people who are afraid of hell, but spirituality is for people who've been to hell and back. And I thought, right. Yeah, that's sort of where these poems started, where I felt like I was in a kind of hell, and what was I gonna do there with it? How could I make something of it that had meaning and a place to hold me together? You know, like, those experiences are threatening to our sense of cohesiveness and our sense of place in the world. Like, do we even belong anymore when our, you know, best friends are gone? Plus, I couldn't see, which is a really, really scary experience.
We're gonna come back to that particular part. I wanna give it much more room a little bit later, but if I could, I'd like to talk a little bit about the interview you did with the Southern Review. And one idea you spoke of was of developing your own personal prayer book in your exploration of spirituality. Can you say more about that, what that means?
So I think what I was thinking of in that interview was the fact that as a kid, you know, I was forced to go to Sunday school, which I actually do think saved my life, because the experience of having the idea that there was a God there that knew what was right and wrong in a family where I was treated really abusively was really comforting to me. But I love the readings from the Torah, because they're, you know, they're the Old Testament, and they have all those amazing stories in them, and they felt real, and people said and did bad things. They weren't all good. But then you got to the prayer book and the language was so vague and meaningless to me. Praise this, praise that. And I've already spoken to that, but it did not move me the way the concrete, ordinary details of the Old Testament did. And so I felt if I could write Psalms that really dealt with everyday language and explore things that have to do with real concrete experiences that really, for me, touch on a feeling of what is sacred, or, you know, as Baudelaire once said, nature is a spiritual house, then maybe I would feel more like I knew how to pray.
It sounds like you were developing or trying to develop a relationship that felt more comforting around the word prayer and what could be offered.
Yeah, but I think even more than that, accessible. Like, I am a person who can't say things I don't believe. I'm really bad at it. Like, my mother always told me I should learn how to white lie. I was really not good at it. And I couldn't say, I mean, after a certain point, I could no longer participate in the, you know, how they have those prayers and you're supposed to say the chorus of the prayer with everybody in the synagogue, and I couldn't do it. I didn't believe in a God that was so perfect and great. My life was never perfect and great. In fact, mostly I just sat there and stewed about how my life wasn't perfect and great. So I didn't want to read that stuff. So I wanted something that was accessible to me. And, you know, it worked. I mean, I did at the end figure out that for me, writing is prayer. And that especially when I get to a point where things cohere and I find a moment of meaning that I didn't know was there, and I find a moment of extraordinary courage or kindness or just these ecstatic moments where it feels like the universe is really not harsh, but actually moments that are benign beyond expectation, then I could feel like this is what it's like to praise. I mean, it's like this idea I have sometimes that praise really is attentiveness. It's not saying how great someone is, it's really seeing them. So to really see my life and to see the people in it and to see the things in it started to feel like prayer. So it worked.
I mean, there's a way, it's almost like you're describing what would be called in a Buddhist tradition, mindfulness. What you brought forward was a higher level of your own attention.
Well, I love that you're saying that, because actually when all these terrible things were happening, I decided I had to do something. So I went to a mindfulness series of classes at this Buddhist place in Sacramento, and oh my God, I hated it so much. I went, I did everything, but I hated it. It was torture, and I did it for a whole year. I meditated and I hated every minute of it. And finally I just decided this just isn't the way it works for me, you know? And I'm not at all sorry I went. I thought the ideas were beautiful and I loved, there's techniques that I learned that I still use a lot, you know, to comfort myself and to change myself from sort of an over aroused state to a more regulated state, but just wasn't for me. So I'm glad you brought that up, and I'm glad it feels that way to you.
Well, again, it seems like you had a one person path that you were following, and part of what we're going to talk about in sort of exploring the collection is what that road was like and what some of the signposts were on there for you. And maybe it approximated some mindfulness or Buddhist practice, but it has to be uniquely yours, and that poetry is part of that search. Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah.
So if it's okay at that moment, can we transition to, can you read another poem for us?
Of course.
Would you read On the YOLO Bypass?
I would be happy. Before I start, can I just say something? So the YOLO Bypass is this really cool part of the Central Valley that's very close to where I live, where it functions as a bridge between where I live in YOLO County and Sacramento County. And it's literally a flood bypass, so that there were so many years where in the old days where Davis was underwater. And so when we have too much rain, it goes in there and literally you can think you're living, you know, on a bay. It's so big. but it's part of the Pacific Flyway. So constantly all the birds are flying through the Yolo Bypass and nesting there and feeding there. And there's lots of ponds and rice fields, and it's really beautiful. It's also, it's noisy because of the freeway, but it's really beautiful. And I love going there, especially in the winter when there's water there. So that's the setting of this. On the Yolo Bypass, I can't know where winter's gone or where my old dog will go down foaming, legs groundless and twitching. Only that a welter of wood ducks will rise up from the wet earth crying. Before he killed himself, Gregory confessed that Jesus had entered his adolescence like a swarm of wasps until he woke one winter, vacated, his soul paper thin, his hammock tied to a tangerine tree, his mouth alive with juice and sting. In a world that holds us hostage, my truck guns through the rice fields, tundra swans bugling overhead, singing, it's okay, it's okay, even if my dog cannot hear, even as I lurch between then and now, the way stations, the small animal clinics, face down in the blonde hummock and pelt of him. A vet shaves my dog's hind paw before needling in what kills. There are days that linger and days that burn. And if you're lucky, a good dog to teach that suffering is not your fault, just a condition of passing through.
In the Southern Review, one of the things you also talked about was the phrase devotional in surrender. That was one thing that poem actually brings to mind, is the evoked contrast to life fighting to preserve itself, this sort of suggestion of letting go, like in the image there. How does the idea of surrender anchor your work?
Wow, that's a big question. I mean, just psychologically, I think anyone who is the victim of trauma has a terror of letting go, an absolute terror of it, because it means loss of control, which is when you had the most terrifying experiences of your life, when you felt out of control. And that poem has a long story behind it. My dog, my beautiful, beautiful dog, he died of probably a brain tumor because he had seizures. And my father was a neurologist who dealt a lot with epilepsy, people who had seizures. And I was, of course, to some degree unconsciously moved into that idea because my father was the person who abused me the most. And the concept of letting go and being held hostage are both definitions of seizure. It's a very interesting word. It means its opposite. As well, so it means also, you know, being taken over, and it means having an experience of a complete loss of control. So it's a very interesting word. I was really playing with that idea, and I was also playing with the idea that my friend Gregory had a terrible, terrible time not being in control. And I love that he had told me that when he was an adolescent, and it totally surprised me, that he had been a Jesus freak, as he called it. You know, he had really, really subscribed to the idea of evangelical Christianity and being saved. And then all of a sudden he said he woke up one day and he didn't believe it anymore. And, you know, that was always something I kind of wished would happen to me, that I would sort of get overtaken by faith, like have some vision or something, and then I would know and I would feel safe in the world. But when you don't have that, you have to find a way to exist between those two extremes of letting go completely and being taken hostage. And the world doesn't help you a whole lot with that. You have to move between those two places. And I think the profound thing for me really was the good dog part of it, because my dog Homer was such a good dog. And it was so clear to me that he did not deserve his suffering. And it really shed light on the fact that as a child, I was always told that when my father abused me, he and my mother would tell me that it was my fault, that I deserved it. And I always knew they were wrong, but you know, I couldn't quite prove it to myself. And watching my dog go through it, I thought, no, this has nothing to do with what you deserve. It's just a condition of being conscious. You know, it's a condition of being alive. It's a condition of living in a world that is both really hard and really beautiful.
That's a really interesting point you're bringing up in terms of your dog, that, and I might be taking this a little bit one step away from where you were speaking about it, but the idea of surrender, the way you're bringing it up, it is part of when, how much we love our dogs, we don't want to let them go. And letting your dog go the way you did in the poem was an expression of love, was letting go of trying to keep him alive for our own needs, yeah? That surrender in that was a form of prayer of love to him, was a form of coming to terms with that, both being held in your love from him and being able to, being kind of sort of out of control, like grief.
Well, I don't think you're taking it too far at all, Avi. I think that's very much what the poem's about. I mean, it was the same with Gregory. You know, I had to find a way. I had to find a way to keep loving him despite the fact that I was so hurt that he left. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I used to tell him all the time, the only thing you have to do is stay alive, but he couldn't do it. And I had to find a way to stay. You know, I didn't want him to go. And it hurt me terribly. And yet, it really wasn't that hard over a period of a few years to figure out exactly what you just said, that first of all, it's not our decision to make. You know, love is love. And if somebody needs to leave, they need to leave. It's not my place to decide that for him. And the same with my poor dog. Like, he was really suffering. In fact, I had to argue with my daughter who owned him that he really needed to get put down. He was just being tormented. But yeah, it is a way of loving to figure out how to let go, because you can't hold on. I mean, the world doesn't let you.
It's a great transition to my next question. That your poems explore spirituality through the lens of the body, through the lens of illness so much in this particular collection, especially. If I can refer to another poem, if I may. In Ordinary Psalm with No Cure, you say, I already know science is a religion too, with its pantheon of evidence, steadying terror. Can you talk a little bit about that idea, science or medicine interceding almost like religion does with suffering and our fears around it?
Well, I'll tell you more what I meant when I wrote that, okay?
That's even better.
Okay. So, you know, when you come at a question like, why is this happening to me? Why am I losing my vision? Why do I have to go blind? You don't really come up with any good answers, you know? And doctors are really good at telling you why on the level of the physical body, right? So they explained it all to me, and it's very complicated, this very rare condition. It doesn't help, really. I mean, I like having the words and the names, but it doesn't really answer the question, why is this happening to me? And I remember when part of why I kind of knew Gregory was going to kill himself was he was so angry that this had happened to him. He was so furious about it. And I thought, that's not going to be a tenable place to live. You can't walk around so angry all the time. You have to feel angry for a while, but then you have to move on to something else. And he wasn't going to. And I think part of what I'm trying to say there is that it is terrifying to lose your vision. There is no way around it. And I do believe in science. I do believe in it. But it's not going to answer the question of how am I going to live with it, with no answer to why me. There is no answer, right? But the other thing is, you know, when you asked me the question, it reverberated to something about when my father was dying. So ironically, he was a neurologist and he died of Lou Gehrig's disease, which is a neurological condition he treated in so many people. And I remember as he was dying, I said to him, you know, Dad, what do you think will happen when you're gone? And he said, I don't believe in anything after the body. There is just the body. And I said, does that scare you? And he said, not at all. It comforts me. And I just thought, wow, you know, good for him, but that's enough. You know, like, I don't know what I think about death. I don't really have any ideas about it, but I love that he knew, and I love that it was enough for him.
That certainty.
That certainty and that sort of deep, deep, deep faith in the physical, real world he had, you know? He didn't need to stretch beyond that, and I love that, you know? He wasn't the reason I went to Sunday school, believe me. If it had been up to him, we would never have gone. That was totally my mom.
So I wanted to speak to what a later part of that same poem, because I think that you're helping us kind of go move to the next point. Later in the same poem, you say, please do not try to make it better. For now there is a hunger in my lips, in my hands, as if I've been called late to wander. And I found that part of the poem particularly haunting, with the very particular words of don't try, the idea of a hunger, being called left to wander, sort of the helplessness of loved ones who watch something happening to someone, like you were saying about your friend, and people who cannot change, the thing with no cure. It's as though the image that it's helped me with was that the person suffering is on their own. And the phrase left to wander, for some reason, I think because there's so much spirituality infused in it, was like to wander alone in the desert with what you have to live with.
Well, I mean, there isn't a moment yet, Avi, where I don't feel really understood by you. So thank you. And so I want to say that poem was written in part about both an external and internal struggle I was having with talking to my husband, who I'm really, really close to. And I feel like there is that funny line where you really want someone to tell you it's going to be okay, and then you cannot be reassured by it because it's not okay. And so I was having this whole conversation both internally and externally in the poem about it. And it does function for me as also my own conversation I had to have around what I wished I could do and say to my friend Gregory and my friend Mary, you know, like especially Gregory. There was never a chance for me to say goodbye to him. There was never a chance for me to say, you know, you were the best friend I ever had and probably ever will have. So there is a way you're wandering in those terrible moments of crisis. You are wandering. And I think the other thing I was trying to say too is I'm going to have to learn to live in the world differently. And it's true. I don't even notice it now. I use my hands so much to get around. Touch has become such a important sense to me that I don't even know half the time that that's how I'm figuring out what's going on around me. And I was just beginning it then. And so it felt a bit like, you know, when you go outside in the dark and you're a kid and you're just sort of feeling your way around and it's really scary, but it's also kind of like you're learning a new language. So it is a bit of a wandering in the desert, but it's also late to wander in the sense of, wow, this is late in my life to have to relearn everything, you know? Although I'm gonna guess in some ways we all go through that. You know, none of us gets to escape illness and death. So I would imagine we all kind of are called late to wander.
Hmm. Well, I also, just to transition a little bit to another of the main themes in the books, is I do think one of the aspects of the book is that you explore through what we call now eco-poetics, sort of the degradation of the earth itself and feelings of melancholy and grief and rage at the loss of our ecosystems while you're sort of losing the visual information that's coming to you, which is so grounding and so obviously the center of your life is your experience with the physical world. Can you talk a bit about the experience of those two phenomena?
Wow. Well, I never even thought to put those two together. You know, I think one of the things I've learned in going blind, or I wouldn't say I'm going blind, I would say I'm near blind, is that there are a lot of other senses to rely on that we don't even pay attention to. You know, I mean, you know, I know you know the difference between a proximal and a distal sense, right? And so, you know, vision is a distal sense. It's, we see things that are far away. Proximal are more like touch and smell and taste. And honestly, the degradation that is in the in my world is very proximal. When the forests are burning and you can't go outside because the air quality index is just terrible, no one needs to see it. You can taste it. You can breathe it. You can feel it. And the same with, you know, I live in a very hot part of California. I live in the Central Valley. And when it gets up to 120, I don't need to see it. I can feel it. You know, I recently wrote a poem after, because as the poet laureate, I am, my whole entire platform is around eco-poetics and poetry of the Anthropocene. And I was out on a ranch as a visitor, and I had been thinking so much about this poem I read by Chase Twitchell, where she's basically saying, the gist of the poem is, why do we talk about anything else? We are destroying our world. How can we talk about anything else? And I was thinking about that. That was a lot in my mind. And I was moving through this orchard, and it was an incredibly hot day, and it was so cool in comparison inside the orchard, but the ground was so dry. I could feel it cracking under my feet, and the leaves on the almond trees, it was an almond orchard, were so dry that they were sharp, like they would hurt you if you touched them. And these are all things that you don't really need vision. Now, I'll tell you what I do need vision for. So there was a bird I was listening to singing, and you know, I had to ask my companion, do you know what bird that is? Do you know what kind of birds are around here right now? Like, that's frustrating me. I can't see that. So in that way, I do lose information. But in a lot of ways, I don't know if I lose information, because really ultimately, when I got to the end of the orchard and suddenly I was looking out at this scorched valley, and the wind was so hot and it was pouring over us and our hair was flying in the wind, the experience of that in a way was, because it's proximal sense, it's more powerful in a way. So I don't know how to answer that, you know, entirely, other than to say I am learning new ways to wander.
Well, I think also it's a commentary, what I'm hearing from what you're saying is that it's a commentary on, it's a multi-sensory degradation of the physical world, and you feel it in all different ways in your body in different sensory information is now being heightened when one is being put back. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's part of what I'm hearing, but yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I'm just thinking about something the late poet Arthur Smith said to me once. He was the my angel mentor. He chose me for, I think he was the one who chose me for the Discovery Award. And when we got to read in the 92nd Street Y, he kind of basically said to me he would be there to help me. And I remember we had so many wonderful conversations, both in person and also, you know, online. And one of the things he said about my work was that it was very kinesthetic. And he said, do you think it's because you've always had terrible vision? And I had never thought about that. So I think it's more of a reliance on the other sense than I would ever want. But in a way, I've always been there. But it reminds me of something else I didn't say to your beginning question about this project. I really wanted to know, too, the concept of spiritual vision versus the, you know, physical experience of perception and sight. You know, what was the relationship between those two things? I don't have an exact answer, but I do think a little bit what I'm saying to you is there is a bit of a spiritual wandering around in the dark that going blind just necessarily requires, right? Like, you don't have a choice. And when you can come through it with a sense of meaning and contact in the world, it does feel like you're developing vision much more than sight. And I'm not saying I would choose this. I wouldn't. I would love to have my vision back, every last bit of it. And I think about, you know, I miss it. I really, really miss it. But it there is something to be said for what are you going to make out of it rather than, and it gets back to that feeling I had with Gregory. Like, if you can't make something out of it, what are you left with?
I think that's a good way to pivot to the next theme that I think is present in your prior collections and in this one. Your other career has been working with abused and neglected children. That work is featured in your poetry often as well. Where do you place your experiences at work with the framework of grappling with God?
You know, that's such a huge question. And I guess I'd have to say, Avi, that my work with those kids made me understand that sometimes we are hurt so badly we don't survive. Sometimes we don't have the luxury of sitting around and trying to figure out how to make meaning. Sometimes we don't even get called to wander. Not even late, not even early. We're just not called to wander. We're destroyed. I do think that when you ask me if that's a religious dilemma for me, that's always at the heart of why I've ever written, is why is there so much beauty next to so much horror? Why is there so much violence next to so much kindness? Why are we given these gorgeous things? You know, like you look at an animal and you think, why is that bird? It's so beautiful, it makes no sense. And then, you know, here we are like pouring poison into rivers. Like, why? It doesn't make any sense. So yeah, that's always been why it's been hard for me to praise God in the traditional ways.
Well, that sort of leads me to my next question about, just to be a little bit more specific, you've alluded to your religious upbringing was Judaism. And it is another thing that I found in this particular collection, is the God that you're speaking to really reverberates as a, and I say this as another Jewish person, as an Old Testament sort of God of Judaism, which is one of sort of capricious, jealous silence that's still worshipped in a kind of a strange way. And it seems like you really engage in a dialogue with that Old Testament God. Did you feel like your particular religious background informed how you took on this questioning?
I don't know how it couldn't, because in a way, when you start as a little girl, you know, I mean, there is a level of indoctrination no matter what, right? And, you know, luckily some of us get to question it as we get older and say, what about that? What about that? And that's partly why I wanted to read other religious texts. You know, I felt like, I better figure out a little bit more about other things that are being said.
One aspect of it I was wondering about was, we often talk about the silences between the words and the part and being part of a poem itself. Did you feel that connected to this idea of this sort of silent, unanswering God figure that you were wrestling with?
Well, I love that you're bringing that up, Avi, because silence is so important in poetry. I mean, it's so much a part of what poetry is, and compression and rhythm and image. So much of it has to do with silence and the music. So I love that you're bringing that up, the silent, unanswering God. And I have to say, I wish I had thought more consciously about that. It's a really fascinating question. You know, it's funny, I don't know that I ever thought about the fact that God didn't answer. And I think maybe it's because my daughter had told me around the time she asked me what I believed in God. She had told me one day she asked God a question and that God had answered, but God doesn't answer the way you think God answers. And that she had gone out to ask God something, and then all of a sudden there was a deer in the meadow, and she took that to be the answer. And she said, so the trick, Mom, is figuring out what it means. It's not that God doesn't answer, it's that you have to figure out what is being said. I guess the reason I've never thought about that is that's sort of what the poems are trying to do. They're trying to figure out what's being said.
Well, that reminds me of a question that might be a little bit off topic, but one of the things I was wondering about as I was reading all these poems was, is there a separation between you and the speaker in the poem, in the voice of the poem? And sort of what you had just said reminded me of that sort of question of like, is it you addressing your life, or is there a persona involved in it? And when you bring up sort of questions of how would God speak to us, it reminds me of my inquiry about the poems.
Well, I love that you're asking that, because I think that's a really important thing for people to remember. Poetry is fiction. It's not memoir. It's not nonfiction. It's fiction. And so you can invent whatever you want it to call. And there is a lot of invention in these poems. There's a lot of, you know, the poem about the October ER really actually wasn't about my friend Mary. I had another friend that had happened to, but it made more sense in the thread of the book for it to be Mary. It would be too confusing. I wasn't watching the elephants on a TV. I had seen that months before, but had been super moved by it. I mean, there's all kinds of things like that. And yes, there, I mean, when I write in God's voice, clearly that's not me. There are so many poems in there where I'm trying things on. I'm wandering. I'm not necessarily knowing. And I have to say, for me, I don't set out really to write a poem. The poem, if I'm working correctly, the poem will write through me. And so it always feels a little bit separate and deeply connected to me. And I don't know how to explain those two things. There's some tension in there between, if I just stuck to my own boring voice and my own boring obsessions over and over, nobody would want to read anything I wrote. Like, I wouldn't want to. So there has to be something that goes on that feels a little bit beyond me when I'm writing. And I love that you asked that question. No, it's not me, but it is.
Do you start with content or do you start with form? How do things tend to come to you?
I start with image, and I try really hard not to be in control. I try to let go. And when I get stuck or I feel like I'm being too predictable, I try to get up and move around and open a book and read a passage. Or, I mean, my whole process is to get outside of my own brain. I don't know how received it feels, although ultimately I'm always kind of, if it's a good poem, I'm kind of surprised, like, oh, I always think I'm never gonna write a decent poem again. I'm almost certain that was the last good thing I will ever write. And I know a lot of writers feel this way. So I'm always surprised when something happens, but to say receive feels a little passive to me. Like, I feel like I work really hard, and there are those incredibly talented people who don't work that hard, but I'm not one of them. I work so hard. I guess I feel like this, that the thing that most connects me to what he's saying about it being spiritual, which I really agree with, is the feeling that you have to be open to receive what the world is giving. Like, the world really does give us things every single freaking day. You know, yesterday I was outside and there was a man pushing his baby. He was an old man. He was clearly a grandfather, if not a great grandfather, pushing this very alert baby in a little baby carriage. And the baby was staring at him, and he was staring at the baby, and he was singing in the most tuneless way as he pushed this little carriage so slowly. And they were like just completely caught in this rapt moment of each other that was just astonishing to me. And I mean, that feels received. Like, I had nothing to do with that. You know, that was just there. And my goal at that moment is, can I pay attention? Can I take it in and not need to know what I'm gonna do with it? Not need to know where it's going to end up, Like, that feels really important to me. Like, letting go of control feels really important to me. I mean, obviously there's all those other moments where you go back into a poem and you have to revise it, you have to figure out how you're going to control it, but certainly not in the initial process of writing it.
Well, it seems like part of what you're saying is that your effort is to protect the image as it is delivered into your senses and not let it be intellectualized.
Yeah, I think that's one way of saying it. I mean, I don't feel any, if something happens where I need to change it, like say I decided it had to be a woman for whatever reason pushing it, you know, like I wouldn't feel bad about that at all. Mm-hmm. If that's what it needed to be. But yeah, not to be intellectualized, not to, and also just not to miss it. Like if you're gonna receive things, you have to go out in the world open mm-hmm. to receiving, right? And there's a lot of painful things that will come in.
Well, getting back to the sort of one of the themes that I was talking about is how that's a beautiful image for us to sort of move into the next question about how to take a tender image, the way that you put that beside a sort of violent or brutal image. And this is the next thing I was going to ask you about is in the poem that you wrote, I might not have the correct name, but about Ordinary Psalm After Another Mass Murder.
Oh, uh-huh, yeah.
Because one of the things I love about that poem is, again, this sort of mindless violence performed solely to create maximum damage. But the poem moves towards, after the turn, to this line. Listen, somewhere in America, a child pokes at a piano, tormenting melody, still convinced that with practice, beauty can be put back together again. That phrase, beauty can be put back together again. There's something about the transmutation of violence from the beginning of the poem into the hands of innocence that really, it's sort of an improbable impossibility. Somewhere, still convinced, can be. It's like the poem promises nothing, but it delivers that sort of delicacy of hope in that one small image.
Well, I love the way you say that, Avi, because that feels exactly what I was trying to do. I was also trying to talk too about the parallel between my own experience of being forced to play piano and the music that I would hear that I would find so beautiful and knowing I couldn't make it, you know. And then this terrible neighbor in the poem who's going to burn our house down but plays this gorgeous music and says such sweet things to his dog, you know. I mean, it's sort of like, I think it's that feeling of knowing because of my work with the kids, because of my work with myself, because of growing up in a family with a very violent father who also really loved me. I think it's that knowledge that at any moment, you don't know what's going to flip, right? You don't know where beauty turns into terror. You don't know where love turns into violence. And it doesn't mean that that particular perception of things is the only one, because there's many lovely, lovely, lovely people in this world that are not like that, mm-hmm. you know, that are much steadier. But I do think it wouldn't make as interesting writing, you know. the dramatic tension, the narrative wouldn't be quite as interesting there.
Well, I just wanted to ask that sort of when you use the term beauty in another poem in the collection, you say beauty sometimes enters like a knife. So you bring this sort of danger and hopefulness within that kind of description. So I just wanted to ask about when you're bringing that word beauty, it seems like you're talking about a larger concept to swirl back to. Is it the sacred? Is it, you know, what is precious in this world? Or I just wanted to ask you a little bit to expand on that.
Well, I would say yes and yes. I'm really talking about, for me, mostly I feel it in the natural world, although I can really feel it in relationship to other people as well, and particularly to children. I feel this real affinity to children's. I mean, it's not that they're nice all the time, they're not. But when they are, and their innocence and their capacity for love, It's interesting, though, that you bring that line up, because it reminds me of something. I did a little experiment with myself once. I was driving out to this place in the coast I love to go, the California coast, and there's one particular spot where when it's not the middle of summer and everything's not brown or burning, you look out and you see this amazing tableau of green, and it's all these hills and trees, and you see a long way, and then there's the ocean, and it's just stunningly beautiful. One day I decided to do an experiment of try to look at this beauty and not stop myself, like not turn away from it, or at least try to figure out what makes me turn away from it. And I realized, actually, it kind of hurts. Like, the way it comes into me, it feels painful. It's so beautiful, it hurts. And it's like, what is that? Why? Like, what is it about beauty that hurts? And I mean, I could come up with all kinds of hypotheses, but I do think there's something about the nature of things that feel so perfectly, impossibly wonderful and gorgeous, and our own deep, deep knowledge of impermanence that creates pain.
Well, it's almost like you're describing the experience of awe has a kind of tinge of melancholy to it.
Yes.
Because of that sort of knowledge, or it brings with it that impermanence.
Yes.
Really opening to it. Yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah. There's always a sense of awe in that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, Julia Levine, it has been a delight to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, can I just say, Avi, you are a wonderful interviewer, and thank you so much for being such a wonderful reader of my work. I am really, really touched.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for listening to this week's Between the Covers here on KBOO Portland 97 FM. I'm your host, Avi Marr, with musical help from John. Thank you.
listening to KBOO Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.